there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the brand new New Books Network seminar. Welcome to all of you listeners, and thanks for joining us on this inaugural podcast. Now, I just had the pleasure of talking with Eric Hyot about his brand new book, The Elements of Academic Style, Writing for the Humanities. This came out in 2014 with Columbia University Press. And this is an extraordinarily important book. It's important, I think, for any of us who are writers ourselves, who do any kind of professional academic or humanistic writing, and or those of us who teach undergraduate and graduate level writing in any of the institutional settings that we work in. And that's a lot of people that fall under those umbrellas. So what this book does is it's organized into a section or into a series of four sections that treat the practice of writing as a lived experience, as a kind of craft, and attend to its not just very practical and sort of low-level tactical elements, but also the kinds of psychological and social components that make for effective academic writing. Each one of the sections treats a different area or a different level of writing as a practice, from sort of thinking about things like, you know, strategies for developing writing habits, ways to think about the institutional structures of academic writing, to thinking about the large-scale structures that govern the different elements and aspects of a piece of writing, from paragraphs to beyond, to very specific low-level tactics like, you know, attending to the rhythm of a sentence, attending to what Hyot calls a kind of ventilation of your writing, thinking about citation practices, footnotes, endnotes. And then finally to the elements of becoming that include not just your own work, your written work becoming itself, but also the transformation into a writer that many of us are in the process of experiencing or hopefully will experience at some point in the near future. So it's an amazing book. It's a book that if I could, I would buy a copy of and give to all of my colleagues and all of my students. And it's one that's already, since I have read it and been thinking about it for the purpose of this conversation, has transformed how I think about my own teaching of writing. This is absolutely going to be coming into my classrooms as of this week, I think, and for many, many years to come. And it's also transformed how I think about my own writing. So I hope you enjoy. It's been absolutely a pleasure to work through. Again, I think this is a really, really important book. So I hope you have a chance to take a look at it, to get a copy for yourself. And thank you for being here with us for this first podcast of the New Book Network seminar. And I hope you enjoy as much as I did. I'm here today to talk with Eric Hyot about his new book, The Elements of Academic Style, Writing for the Humanities. Welcome to the New Books Network seminar, Eric, and thanks for being our inaugural interview with this brand new seminar. Thanks for making time to talk with me today, and in particular, for making time to talk about a book that I'm really, really excited about. So welcome, thank you, and congratulations on a fantastic book.
Thanks so much. I'm excited to talk about it. And also, I guess, you know, who knows? I mean, the seminar can only get better from here.
Well, I'm really grateful. And I'm also really, like I said, really excited about the book. And one of the reasons why we are talking about this particular book as a way of inaugurating this new seminar is that rather than, at least in my reading of it, rather than being a book that's particular to a very limited academic field, this is a book with potentially very wide-ranging relevance and wide-ranging consequences across different fields of humanistic writing. So this is a writing guide that you've written, and a writing style guide in particular, geared specifically toward academic writers in the humanities, and academic we can understand in its broadest possible connotations there. Now, you talk a little bit about what brought about the decision to create a book like this, to create this kind of object with this particular shape in the book itself. But for listeners now, as a way of getting us started and bringing us in, can you talk a little bit about what brought you to this project? How did you decide that we needed a book like this and that you were the person to write it?
Well, yeah, I think the thing I want to say first is I really love academic writing, and I love it. I don't love all of it, obviously, and half of it is below average by definition. But you know, I partly became interested in becoming an academic and becoming a scholar because I read things that moved and inspired me, and one of the things that I found historically very frustrating about being in academia is that most of the writing advice that I see out there for writers of scholarly prose tends to be written from the perspective that insists that most of it is bad and that most of it is wrongheaded, and that the reason that most of it is bad and wrongheaded is because academics are narcissistic or stupid or shallow or are masking their lack of self-confidence or their tiny penises with sort of longer words and sort of, you know, a kind of phallic sort of self-protection and obfuscation that's designed to sort of conceal the fact that they were the people, as one historian once put it, who were sitting against the wall during the dances in high school. And so, you know, this struck me, first of all, as a kind of advice and a kind of attitude towards academic writing that didn't feel like it respected or valued much of what I respect and value in academic writing, and that treated, I guess, my liking of those things as though it were sort of somehow pathological. Now, of course, Carla, as everyone knows, I have an incredibly tiny penis, but I'm not really, whatever. I don't know how to finish that joke. But I mean, I guess I wanted to insist at some point that I don't feel like the fact that I love things that are complicated, that are abstruse, but also that are often very beautiful and moving, that are able to sort of bring together ideas in exciting ways if you give them the opportunity to, makes me somehow, or simply the product of a kind of self-delusion. In which what I fail to recognize is that if I could just get over the fact that I was humiliated in high school, I would be okay now, and then I could learn to love writing in a kind of plain style. And so that, you know, I mean, in some sense, that emotional frustration is at the heart of the book, which is that I felt like we needed a book that would be written for people who do academic writing, beginning from a place that loved much of what happens in academic writing. Kristen, I don't love everything, but I love many things. And also beginning from a place of deep compassion for the difficulty of academic writing and for the sort of the pain and the hurt and the fear that are wrapped up in the process of academic writing, and including my own.
Mm-hmm. I think that's actually really crucial because so much of us, or so many of us at so many stages of the development of ourselves as and into academic writers or writers at all, sort of contend with fear, contend with, you know, the realities that a lot of the time we're writing out of fear. And does it have to be that way? Why should it be that way? And the sort of recent, I think, criticisms of academic writing that you may be alluding to, that I certainly have seen circulating around the groups I'm part of in Facebook and on the Chronicle of Higher Education, etc., they tend to just kind of magnify that fear, I think, by defining what academic writing is and what it must be in a way, in a very, very limited way that also almost makes us more afraid of this craft that we've taken on than, you know, than is productive. And so this is one of the things I really like about the book is that you sort of get in there, you look at it in the face and you open it up and explode this idea that we have to be thinking about academic writing as looking really, you know, one particular stultifying way, and that we have to write out of fear and out of, you know, aloneness with that fear.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll say this. I think I don't really know what it's like to write without some fear. And I, you know, part of what I do in the book is I try to suggest that the very natural fear that one has when writing scholarship in particular is the product of the ambition that one has for the work and of a fear that one isn't good enough to do what one is ambitiously trying to do. And so, you know, when you put it that way, it doesn't seem unreasonable to be afraid. I mean, that is, every time I write a piece of scholarship, I am trying to write something that is amazing and interesting and will inspire people and make my friends think that I, you know, they're really happy to be friends with me because I'm such a good writer. And that's really hard. And it doesn't get easy, ever, because I think you're always trying to do something that's better than the things you've done before. You know, a lot of writing advice seems to be about mastering or getting over fear through the production of rules. And my feeling is this fear is a rational fear, and it's okay. And it's okay to understand it as a kind of fear that's the product of desire and you know, one doesn't have fear, for instance, as I point out in the book, when one writes a grocery list, right? Because I'm not afraid that I can't accomplish that task. So when you think of fear that way, then you realize that fear becomes, at least for me, less of an enemy and more of a companion to the process of writing. And it also becomes an entryway into a community of others who are also afraid. And so it's a question of then writing maybe a little bit afraid, but in some sense, the fear bites less when one is not alone in one's fear, and when one also manages to sort of think of one's fear as a fundamental part of what one has begun aspiring to do. And at that point, fear is a choice, and fear is a way of being in relation to the writing that doesn't have to cripple the writing, but can actually be simply part there as part of what one lives when one writes this kind of work.
That's right. And I think that that's really crucial because the book is doing a kind of work, at least from my perspective as one reader of it, right, which is all I can really speak for and speak to. But the book is doing a kind of work to acknowledge that fear, make it part of the process, but also to give us a way of being afraid together rather than being afraid alone. And that's a fundamentally different kind of experience.
Right.
So creating a kind of companionship really, for me, feels like it's at the heart of many elements of the book. And we'll talk about some of the explicit ways that that's the case, I hope, by the end of our conversation. But implicitly, it's the case in part in the way that you're framing, both at the beginning and also throughout the book, the way that you're asking us to use and encounter the book. I think on page 80, you say, "This is a book that wants you to surpass and destroy it in the best possible way, right? To kind of make it your own and to integrate these ideas into your lived practice and then transcend it." And so in many ways, you're presenting this book to us as a work in progress, as an instrument to be used and integrated. And I really love that about it. So companionship and the writing process is, again, very much at the heart of many elements of the book. And another element of the book in which this is the case is clear from the very beginning. So the book is organized into four major sections. And the first section looks at writing as a practice. And you lay out what's covered under this one section of the book. This covers, among other things, how to think of writing, as you put it, as a dynamic practice that includes behavioral, emotional, and institutional parameters, how to develop effective writing habits, how to match your writing to the different contexts that you're working within, and how to orient your work to the experience of the reader. And so we'll talk about some of these in the course of our short time together. Now, one of the really fascinating points that comes up in this section that's of, you know, really immediate importance to me as somebody who works in a graduate program, who trains graduate students, and who talks about writing in graduate programs all the time without the kind of tools to really understand how to effectively train students for the realities of the writing world that are going to, you know, be part of their lives after graduation, is you talk about the current state of writing instruction in graduate programs. Okay, this is crucial. I want to make sure that we spend time talking about this because this is one of the potentially most, I think, transformative elements of the book in terms of how we can take this book and use it to really think about transforming how we teach. And I really mean that. I'm not being hyperbolic here. I mean, this could be really transformative for how we teach in graduate programs. So let's start there. And I'm just going to keep this very open. Can you talk a little bit about how your perception of the current state of writing or teaching writing in graduate programs in the humanities and how you are attempting to deal with that, change that, transform that in a way that makes sense to you, given what you're talking about in the book?
Mm-hmm. Well, so I'll say a couple of things. I mean, first of all, that to me, the problem is fundamentally institutional rather than located in the practice of an individual teacher, which is not to say that individual teachers can't actually help ameliorate the situation. And I'll describe what I think the situation is in a moment. But also that as I describe the situation, what I want listeners to hear is that this situation is the product of decisions that are made essentially at the departmental level. And that changing the situation actually involves rethinking in a kind of structural and institutional way the basic way that graduate school works in the humanities. So let me back up. if you look at the way that we train students to write in the first 2 to 2.5 years of their coursework period, which is, of course, particular to the U.S. and Canadian academic model, right? What we do is we ask them over and over to, at the end of a semester in which they've spent some time reading books assigned by another person, write a 20 to 25 page paper that has something to do with those books and maybe some books of their own, not always, but sometimes. If you came from Mars and you said, what are you preparing these students to do? You'd say, oh, they must be getting ready for a job in which they spend all their time writing 75 pages over 3 to 4 weeks on 3 topics chosen by other people. Right? But that would actually be wrong. I mean, it would be fundamentally wrong about what we do, right? If we think about how the faculty actually write, no faculty member writes in the way that we train our students to write for those first 2.5 years. So is it any small wonder then that when the students who have been trained in this, let me pause, this is a training not just in a genre of writing, the seminar paper, which has a very particular sort of set of structures and patterns, but it's actually a training in a behavioral, physically embodied mode of writing practice, right? That is its training in a kind of muscle memory and a physiological and psychological memory and habit and set of habit patterns that are built around the idea of writing 3 papers in 3 weeks, right? So that shapes the way that one reads when one is writing one of seminar papers. There's a lot of skimming going on. There's a lot of trying to put things together quickly. There's obviously much less revision. There's a lot of late nights. There is a kind of a manic quality to the entire thing, right? And all of this is essentially training and muscle memory, right? That then, okay, so now is it any surprise that when they then get to the moment where they're supposed to write the first dissertation chapter, it takes so many of them a year? They've never written anything, for the most part, that's 60 pages long. They've certainly never written anything that's 50 or 60 pages long with any guidance from their faculty. They've never worked on a project for 9 to 12 months at a time. They've never been asked to do the kind of archival research that a historian would normally do before writing the chapter, right? They've never had to think about what it means to write something of that length and hold that sort of stuff together in terms of a sort of genre or structure. And they've never actually had to write at the level of density, including the level of footnote density and of citational density that actual publishable work is written at, because in seminar papers, they don't actually cite or footnote in the same ways, right? So they get there and it takes them a year. And we think, oh, why does it take them a year? Now, some people it doesn't take a year, right? I don't know why those people are lucky. Maybe they had a great education, but it takes many, many people a year and many people more than a year to write that first chapter. And, you know, the faculty in this kind of crazy way then get frustrated and think, what's wrong? Why aren't they writing? It's because we haven't taught them how to do the thing we're asking them to do. And, you know, it seems to me that if you have a basic ethics of pedagogy, it should be try to teach people to do the thing you're asking them to do. We don't teach them how to do the thing we're asking them to do. And that's the problem, right? And it's not to say that seminar papers don't teach people anything. Right. But they teach people a very particular set of things. Right. Some of which are useful. Some of which, as I'm pointing out, are not useful. That is, they train people toward an embodied practice that is actually the wrong practice. No successful academic that I know writes in the way that we train students to write seminar papers. And yet we teach them to do that. And we put them in that situation for, 4, 5, 6 consecutive semesters. And tell them that if they're succeeding at that, that's a sign that they're going to be great at everything else. Mm-hmm. When, it's not. In the same way that playing soccer is not a sign you're going to be good at basketball. Yes, you might get fitter playing soccer and you might learn some things about space and movement and teamwork and so on, right? That might then help you on the basketball court. But there's no reason to assume the skills directly transfer. And so what's weird to me is the absolute lack of consciousness. And again, this may be much more ironic for people in literature departments than for people in history departments, but among the very people who are teaching undergraduates how to write, mm-hmm. right? And among the people who are supposed to be among the most thoughtful scholars and thinkers about the act of writing and how writing works. So that's the part that's deeply crazy making to me, and the part that seems to require a radical rethinking of what it is we do in graduate school. Now, I'll just go on. I mean, I'll say that one of the ways that someone could criticize me, and in fact, people have been critical of me for saying these kinds of things, is you're talking about training professors, but we don't train professors. We train intellectuals, right? So there's a kind of opposition that's set up between what it means to train someone to be a thinker and what it means to train someone in a kind of highly professionalized way that's oriented towards the demands of a specific profession, which, you know, the critique goes, is the product of neoliberal forces attacking the university and creating publication demands, blah, blah, blah. You know, there are lots of things one can say about that critique. One of the things to say is I don't think that the opposition between the intellectual and the professional writer or the scholarly writer is as clear as people think it is. It's pretty clear that the major way that we consume intellectualism is through the written word. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it doesn't strike me as a coincidence that many of our great intellectuals are also powerful writers. You know, it's also possible, I suppose, to be an intellectual and be a terrible writer, although, again, at the limit, if you were so terrible that you couldn't write, then no one would ever really know you were an intellectual. So, you know, I don't know. But it does seem to me that critique actually contains within itself a kind of theory an idea that there's a fundamental opposition between thinking and writing that is, I'll just put it this way, wrong. I mean, that is, I think it's patently wrong, provably wrong. And all you have to do to understand that is to read like the last sort of 100 years of what loosely goes under the name of theory, right? Which suggests over and over to us that in fact, the way that things are written is part of the measure of how they're thought and part of the measure of what makes them thinkable. And so part of what I would say is I'm training intellectuals who communicate and I'm training people how to communicate as intellectuals. And part of that communication involves communicating within the norms of a profession. If someone wants to be a genius who writes in a cave and whose work is discovered later, that's fine. And then maybe they can do what they want. But I think for our graduate students who are ostensibly being trained, you know, in relation to a profession, but even in relation to sort of an idea of an intellectual, that idea is completely implicated in the forms of production and consumption of knowledge that we engage in all the time. And so the critique seems to me a bit nonsensey, but also really defensive. You know, if you want to criticize the publication treadmill, I think there are things to criticize about the publication treadmill, but that doesn't, for me, necessarily negate the idea that we should be teaching people how to write or how to engage in a kind of professional practice or an intellectual practice, depending on how you feel about this, that resembles the intellectual and professional practices of the people who are trying to teach them. Right. So again, like if you think being intellectual requires doing what you do as a professor, which is to spend 2 or 3 or 4 years working on a project, writing slowly and spending a lot of time in the summer and writing every day and doing archival research and so on and so forth, then why do you train your graduate students over the course of their first 2 years over and over in a practice that resembles that practice not at all?
Right.
And what is the relation between then that practice? Do you have a theory, pedagogically speaking, of the relation between seminar papers? Because someone could say, actually, the best way to learn how to be an intellectual later on is to do this thing. And I know it doesn't look like it, right? That would be a kind of Karate Kid version of the instruction. So Daniel is like waxing on and waxing off.
Wax off theory.
Right. And he thinks he's not learning anything. Right. Yeah. He thinks he's not learning anything. But it turns out later that he is actually learning something. Mm-hmm. If that's what you're doing, great. I'd like to see the rationale. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I'm all for the idea that what we could do is we could break down the basic skills of book writing and article writing into a set of sub practices. Right. It's not that the only way to learn how to write a book is to write a book, though. Obviously, that's a good way to learn how to write. Right. But there may be other things that go into learning how to write a book that you can learn in smaller scale structures over the course of a couple of weeks. You could practice paragraphing. You could practice footnoting. You could read my book about, you know, learn about citational practice and so on and so forth. There are kinds of things you could learn that don't have to involve just writing the whole book.
Right.
And there again, you are back at this kind of wax on, wax off model. But that seems to me to be a powerful pedagogical model. The reality is if the seminar paper is part of a generalized process in which you say what you're doing in the seminar paper is you're learning to handle a 25-page idea. And there's something really valuable about the challenge of holding that idea and experiencing what it's like to have that 25-page structure in your hands, working back and forth either on paper or in a file, and to learn and encounter the particular problems that come with that, with thoughts of that length. Mm-hmm. That would be great. Mm-hmm. It would be also great if you told students that's what the seminar paper was for.
Right.
And you put that seminar paper in the context of a series of other modes of instruction that let them encounter the other things that are part of the way that we learn and we write.
Right. And in fact, you're actually giving, I mean, you briefly mentioned kind of offhand citational practice, right, just a couple of minutes ago. And you actually are giving very concrete examples in the book of not just what one might do to start getting toward a mode of teaching academic writing in a graduate context that did resemble more of the kind of model of, integrating particular exercises that were meant to help train them to master particular practices that are actually practices that we actually use when we're doing actual academic writing, right? Mm-hmm. And you talk about some of them. So one of them that you talk about that I was actually really interested in is precisely this exercise that you describe that you use with your students, or that you say you use with your students, that's about citational practice, where you have them just kind of make up quotations. Mm-hmm. Right. So can you talk about that, and maybe some other things that you do in your own classroom that are related to this that you found particularly useful that you might suggest that others might consider adopting as well?
Okay. Well, so one of the things that you'll notice if you read a bunch of seminar papers and then you look at published work, published articles, right, is that published articles are much more densely citational. They have more footnotes, but they also cite secondary scholarship more than seminar papers do. And we all understand why that happens. But one of the things that means is that when students write seminar papers, they are actually, again, practicing. Think about this as a kind of embodiment or kind of muscle memory. They're practicing writing paragraphs that are actually wrong in terms of the kinds of writing you need to do in an article. And the problem, of course, with the seminar paper is students don't have the time to do the research they would need to put all the footnotes in and to put all the citations in. And so what that means is when they get to the dissertation, they don't actually necessarily, they haven't been taught. They might figure it out on their own, but they haven't been taught how, in some sense, academic writing is built and structured and how to use the work of others to support, extend, and enliven your argument. So what I have my students do is we sit down and we first of all, I tell them what I've just told you, and we look at the differences. So we look at some seminar papers, we look at some articles. We actually make a list. What are the kinds of footnotes people have? Let's go through and let's typologize them. Okay? And then we look at the quotes and we say, what kind of quotes do people, what do people use secondary criticism for? How do they use it? What's the difference between using someone and quoting a full sentence, or just referring to them in a footnote, or maybe only quoting them as part of your own sentence? So you have a sentence where you have your own words and then you quote a few of their words and then you end the quote and you continue going with your own language, right? How are these, what are the different kinds of ways of doing this stuff? And then once we've kind of made a rough typology, let's say four types of footnotes, five types of quotations, then I just say, okay, well, now in your next paper, you have to do one of each of these. And also what I want to see is I want to see that you have the rough level of density for doing these that the article has rather than the seminar paper. Now, they can't do the research to do this. And so what I say is you should just make up the quotes, mm-hmm. right? You should make up the quotes. You should make up the secondary sources. So if you get to a moment where you think, okay, if I were in an article, this would be a moment when I would have one of those, cover your ass style footnotes, where I'm kind of showing that I've read a bunch of secondary criticism, but I don't really want to deal with it. But I want to make sure that the reader doesn't sort of doubt my authority, mm-hmm. then you put that footnote there, and then you give me that footnote in the correct format with made up names of books and made up authors so that you understand, right, what you're practicing is what I would think of as the rhetoric of academic style. That is the sort of modes of persuasion and the modes of production that go into actually producing publishable work. Similarly, right, one of the things students almost never do, and it's really, really useful, is what I call the partial quote, right, which I described a minute ago, where you quote someone in the middle of your own sentence. And it's a really, really powerful way of engaging with someone else's argument within the frame of your own argument and of using that person to lend you a certain kind of referential authority without getting sort of in too much of a kind of genuflected position to their work. Mm-hmm. And so we talk about that. We talk about how that works. And we look at examples. And then, I want the student to get to a moment in the article where they would think, this would be a good moment for me to do this. And to figure out what is the grammar pattern that they're going to need? How are they going to have to write a sentence that develops that structure and leaves itself open to that structure? And then what is the quote that they need, right? And so then they can make up the quote. And obviously in the future, when they do real scholarship, they're not allowed to make up the quotes. But here at least, the point is, this is practicing the very thing that they need to learn how to do. And it's teaching them actually how to write the correct format. So that's, you know, that's a small thing. Let me give you an example of something at the institutional level that we've just institutionalized here at Penn State that I think responds to some of these issues, not at the kind of micro level within a single classroom, but at a larger level. We have just set up what we're calling a kind of summer writing fellowship. What is this? It is a program in which students in the fall who are writing a seminar paper apply for this program. And if they get in, they spend the spring semester doing an independent study with one of our faculty. The goal of the independent study is to do the background reading and the kind of large-scale thinking that will govern the transition between the seminar paper that they've written in the fall semester and an article that they're going to produce over the summer. So they're doing this independent study. They're meeting with a faculty member once a week. They're working on the reading. They're talking about the reading with the faculty member. The faculty member has read the paper, obviously. They are also, obviously, as part of the subtext, talking about the paper. At the same time, these five students are meeting with a writing coach who is going to teach them the kind of things I'm talking about with you. So we'll look at articles. We'll talk about what's the difference between article seminar paper. We'll talk about sort of focusing articles in specific journals and so on. Then we get to the summer. And we pay them. We give them $4,000 so that they don't have to teach. And we give them a $1,000 research budget so that they can travel to an archive or something like that. And they spend then the summer writing. We have this is a kind of kooky idea, but you'll like it. I think other people think it's silly. But I'm making something called the Gold Star Writing Club, where we have a big chart. It's called the Gold Star chart. And everyone who comes in, this is actually for all the graduate students. Everyone who comes in for at least 3 hours into the office and writes gets a gold star. And then at the end of the summer, we'll have pizza once a week and so on. And then at the end of the summer, there'll be a lottery and you'll get a number of tickets that's the same as the number of gold stars you have. Mm-hmm. And we'll raffle away an iPad. And I think one of our gifts is I'll come clean your house. one of my students said that they would feel like they had to clean their house first before I got there in order to make sure it was clean enough for me to clean. But in any case, what we're going to do with our writing fellowship students then is that they're also going to meet and workshop their own work over the course of the summer. Right, so they spend the whole summer working on this transition from the seminar paper to the article. They've done all the reading at this point. Theoretically, they've visited an archive if they need to visit the archive. And this process continues then with them engaged with each other, and they have this writing coach. And they're also partially engaged with the person they did the independent study with. And then by October 15th of the following fall, right, the fall after the summer, they're then required to submit this paper to a journal in their field. So this is ideally happening in the second or third year, the transition between the second and the third year. And the idea was to basically integrate into our and ultimately we have enough funding to do this. We're a very small program. We have enough funding to do this for all of our second year students. Mm-hmm. So basically, it's now become something that's completely integrated into the process of getting a PhD in comparative literature at Penn State, right? Where actually part of being in the program in your second year is that you actually go through this process, so that by the time you start writing the dissertation, you've had the experience of thinking about the difference between the kind of writing you've been doing in your seminar papers and academic style, scholarly style. You've had the experience of working on something for about a year, because you have to apply, you know, in October 15th of the fall of your second year, and then you submit in October 15th of the fall of your third year, right? So you've had, again, thinking about that embodied sort of muscle memory, psychological memory process, what it means to think about something for a year, what it means to watch something grow over the course of a year. And change, and how that, you know, and again, we'll do this thing at the end where we look back at the seminar paper and then we look at the article, and we all have this kind of, I hope, oh my God, moment of realizing how far all of these pieces of work have come. And finally, because this piece of work in most cases is going to be part of the dissertation, it means that when they start writing their dissertations, usually in the spring of their third year or the summer after their third year, they actually start the first chapter of their dissertation with 25 to 30 pages mm-hmm. of publishable material mm-hmm. that then forms a kind of foundation of that chapter. And that ideally means that instead of taking a year on their first chapter, they're going to be able to do their first chapter in 6 months, which then gives them more time to do the second chapter and the third chapter and so on. Right. So the whole point of this institutional structure is that it has changes up and down the graduate curriculum in terms of affecting not only what's happening in their classes, because as they choose which class to take or as they choose which seminar paper to use. And then, of course, in their classes with the individual faculty member doing an independent study, but also then to their entire writing practice, to their comps exam potentially, and of course, to their dissertation. And what's more, because all of the first year students know that they're going to have to do this in their second year. When they choose their seminars in the fall, they are already choosing their seminars with an eye towards thinking about which of these seminars will produce the paper that is going to lead into this. So from their very first year, our students are aware that learning how to do this thing and doing this thing is in fact part of the process of moving towards becoming a scholar.
That's amazing. And, you know, my first question, or well, one of the questions that I would have immediately listening to this, aside from, you know, how can all of us do this in our programs? It sounds amazing. But then if you're thinking the question of whether you have been thinking of scaling this up, because, you know, scalar relationships between the components of a structure in terms of writing and scalar relationships in terms of the components of practice is very much at the heart of the book. So, you know, my first question would be, you know, have you considered scaling this up to the dissertation process as a whole? But you actually address that in the book in a really interesting way. And so let's maybe continue by talking about that a little bit. You talk in the book about a practice in which you're sort of advising graduate students who are writing dissertations by asking them to think about the book first, and then sort of after conceiving the book project, then working backward and thinking about, okay, what form of this or what component of this book project does the dissertation make sense as part of? And I'm not being articulate, but I know you will be. So can you talk a little bit about that, the sort of thinking about the book before writing the dissertation and how that shaped your experience of graduate mentoring as a writer, as well as a, you know, as a scholar?
Well, so again, part of this is, you know, I will say that I tend to be a really practical person. So part of this really is a response to the practicalities of academic life today, which is that, you know, it's very hard to get tenure in a Research One institution if you don't turn your dissertation into your first book, right? If you put it away and you write another book, you almost certainly have to switch jobs. So that's a kind of problem, right? Now, you know, often when people do that, their books are better. And so that's, you know, it's not a terrible strategy, but I think it's a complicated and very fraught strategy. Part of the problem, if you read the other writing books that are out there, and there are a number of books that talk about the transition from a dissertation to a book, right, is that what they assume is that people have written something that belongs to a genre called the dissertation that is essentially not really ready to ever become a book and will require radical transformation. Part of what I wanted to do was to say, well, what would happen if instead of having people write this genre called the dissertation, you actually had people write essentially a junior book, right? And what I mean by a junior book is a work that doesn't require fundamental reconstruction in order to become a book, but rather requires revision, you know, potentially extensive revision, and also extension to become a book. And so what happens if you have the student thinking and modeling their work on a book, or rather on the book that the dissertation will become, once it's complete, and then you've had 2 to 3 to 4 years, as people do, to take that work and turn it into a publishable artifact. So I just had a student defend, actually, on Wednesday, which was great. And one of the things I said to her, and this happens a lot, is that the introduction to the dissertation is the first place where it was the first thing that she had ever written that she wrote as someone who'd written a dissertation. And until she wrote the introduction, she had been someone who didn't know if she could write a dissertation. And it really shows at the level of style. I mean, what happens is that as she's writing this introduction, she's figuring out what she did in ways that allow her to explain what she did and how it works in ways that are more sophisticated, in fact, than actually appear in the chapters. This is a totally normal process. In fact, it happens to me still with every book I write. And so what it means is that you then have to go back, of course, through the chapters and bring the chapters up to the level of the introduction and, in fact, teach the chapters what the introduction knows. You know, this is ironic because, of course, the chapters are what the introduction knows, but the chapters themselves don't know what the introduction knows. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's precisely through what the introduction learns when it's being written last, and I should say I teach all my students to write the introduction last, that then this process reveals the book as a kind of total thing. At that point, we spent most of the defense, and it was clear that she was going to pass, we spent most of the defense talking about the different books this book could become, right? That is, or the different books this dissertation could become. We had begun, I will say, way back when, that is 3 years ago when she started writing, talking about what kind of book might this be. And of course, you know, when you go on the market as a graduate student, you always have to talk about how you're going to turn your dissertation into a book, and it's a very common job question. So this is a useful thing for people to be thinking about. But part of also what I was trying to manage when we had those conversations was that I wanted students to be focused on a manageable version of the project rather than the most ambitious version of the project without feeling like they had to give up on ambition. So there is a kind of ambitious version of the book that my student Grace wrote that exists and that she's had in mind, and that she never has felt like she had to give that up to do something doable, because what she's done is she's written a dissertation that's essentially 3/5 maybe 3/4 of that book. Mm-hmm. And so in doing that, first of all, it gives the work of the dissertation a kind of scope and scale that I think is exciting for students. And at the same time, it allows them to graduate in a reasonable amount of time, mm-hmm. right? And to focus on manageable chapters. And I think part of it is also, you know, to be open, even at the beginning when Grace and I were talking about this, we had kind of 2 or 3 versions of the book this book might be in mind. And as it's grown and as she's written the chapters and it's become clear what it is, you know, some of those versions have changed. A couple of them have dropped out and a couple new ones have emerged. And so that's part of the intellectual decision she's going to have to make. But I feel like the basic principle, right, which is that the dissertation is a junior version of an ambitious book that can be the first book, feels like a really good pedagogical principle. I feel like it emotionally works really well with my students in any case. And I also think that it puts the relationship between the dissertation and the first book into a kind of really useful perspective, in which the first book is seen and the years working on the first book are not seen as, I think, as they often are by junior faculty, and certainly more by me and some of my colleagues, as kind of this tedious taking of something you thought you were done with and turning it into the thing that would satisfy other people, even though you weren't that interested in the project anymore. Right. And turns those years into years that you spend thinking of yourself as continuing to develop as a writer and thinker through your work on this project, right? Which then becomes not a project that you begin with the idea of finishing it 2 years, but rather a project that you begin with the idea of reaching an important way station called the dissertation defense in 2 to 3 years, and then finishing it in 2 to 3 more years after that. And that the project of developing intellectually and developing, you know, as a scholar and developing the power and force of the work then continues over those 6 years, rather than simply being something where you're done with something. And why are these people all making you do more on it, even though it's actually done?
I mean, I love this for several reasons, and I know you know I'm going to love this, right? But I love this part of it in part because it helps speak back to, I think, the problem that a lot of us have when we're not thinking about and haven't been trained or haven't, you know, realized we can think about the relationship between the dissertation and the book in this way, which is that a lot of us in, being at the point where we're transitioning from dissertation to book, get to the point where we're just so sick of the project that a lot of people, you know, just hate their first books, like don't want to talk about them, because you're so sick of it and there's so much pressure and so much resentment involved mm-hmm. in the process. Mm-hmm. Or people who are trained to think about the dissertation and the book as being two completely different genres, you know, two completely different things without having a sense of how to connect the two that's built into the process of conceiving and writing the dissertation itself.
Right. And so like, if you think, I mean, imagine there, I could understand, first of all, well, let me say 2 things. So one is the resentment you're describing is really real and it's very painful. And it's depressing that we live in a profession in which that happens often enough that I assume everyone listening to this podcast will know someone, maybe they themselves will have gone through that kind of process. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's bad, right? Minimally, as people who care for each other, we should look at that and say, no, you know, that's not a good outcome for the kind of profession this is. And so what would happen? How could we make that different? The second thing is, if you think of a dissertation as really genuinely different from a book, and there are faculty who believe that, and there are programs who train that way, you at least need a theory of what the hell you're doing making someone write one.
Right.
Right. I mean, so if you say, okay, your dissertation is not a book and it's this different thing and you have to do it this way and then you're going to write a book. You know, again, pedagogically, what's the justification? What's the rationale? And not just what's the justification rationale, but obviously choosing to do that means not choosing to do it the way that I'm describing. So are you sure that your way is that much better than this other way that Hayo is describing in his book? I'm not necessarily positive that my way is better, but I have some intuitions that it might be. And I certainly think that minimally, I've actually articulated a kind of ethos that seems rational that I understand and that so far on the basis of my relationships with my students seems to be working. So, you know, we'll see, in the long run. But I would say minimally, then again, if you have a practice, you should know why you have that practice, and you should have considered that practice in relation to the alternatives that are out there.
Mm-hmm. So the book also includes, so along with all of these really wonderful discussions of the kinds of transformations that we can try to implement in terms of how we teach our students, and how students, you know, take agency in learning themselves how to write. You also have a lot of advice for those of us who are done with graduate school, who are grappling with having writing lives and integrating it into our practice in the midst of all of the thousands of other things that are competing for our time. And so there's a whole section on strategies for writing that I won't go into in any detail, but I just want to mark this so that listeners know that it's there, which includes things like, you know, write daily, include strategies for keeping on writing when we're stuck, also includes, I think, some really helpful and very sympathetic and humane advice about avoiding virtuous procrastination, like all the things that are competing for our time that are really, that feel worth doing, but that get in the way of, you know, making time for writing. so that's a really useful, I think, part of the book. Now, there's a whole part of the book devoted to strategy as well, in which you're talking about, as you put it, large-scale structures that govern the production of scholarship in literary and cultural studies, and I think also beyond literary and cultural studies. I think a lot of this, most of it applies absolutely well to history as well, which is my field. Now, we can't talk about all of the wonderful things that are happening here, but one of the premises that you're introducing in this section really governs what's happening in the rest of the book, and I want to at least have a little bit of time to talk about it, and that is this idea of the uneven you. Mm-hmm. So can you introduce for us this idea of the uneven you? What's going on here? Why is it important? And how, in your opinion, does integrating this into how we think about the structure of our writing potentially, like, what potentially can this do to transform the way we write practically?
Well, I'll say a couple different things about it. First of all, you know, some hesitation about the name, the uneven you, but I had to call it something. So there it is. I mean, the you is the reason it's uneven is because the sort of the left arm of the you, or the left riser of the you, is lower than the right riser. For those of you, that's impossible to describe in a podcast, but there are pictures in the book, so yeah, it's clear. What that describes is what I think is both a very good structure, but also a very common structure in academic writing. And so, you know, the book is this weird sort of goes back and forth between what I think was kind of prescriptive and descriptive advice. And so there are parts of the book that really are saying, look, this is what people do. And then sometimes I say, and by the way, I think of all the things that people do, this one seems like the most effective for me, and here's why. Right. And so the you is really part of that, which is to say the you is a way of describing something that I think genuinely happens in academic writing, and that helps make academic writing powerful. But it's also a way of prescribing a kind of pattern or structure that can usefully help writers build paragraphs and build the larger structures that paragraphs belong to. So sections, chapters, and even sort of the rhythm of an entire book. The basic thing that the uneven you and my advocacy for the uneven you resists is a kind of highly instrumentalized form of writing advice that involves strong, explicit signposting in the form of, in this paper, I will make three claims, 1, 2, and 3, followed by then section 1, the first claim, section 2, the second claim, section 3, the third claim, and then a conclusion that says, in this paper, I have made three claims. These were the claims in case you didn't see them the first time. Ta-da. Right. And there's a lot of writing advice, both at the undergraduate and even the graduate level, that essentially is arguing for that kind of structure. And I guess what I'll say is I just find that writing boring. I mean, that is what we know in general about writing and about the way that writing creates emotion, is that there's a lot of emotion generated by the forces of anticipation and the forces of surprise and the forces of revelation. And this kind of highly explicit signposted work takes advantage of none of those forms. So imagine if you say instead, you know, in this essay, I'll be dealing with these three problems. By the end of it, I'll reveal that, in fact, these three problems are all the same problem. At that point, I'm willing to keep reading because you haven't told me exactly how, but you've set up a kind of mystery, right? It's like by saying by the end of the evening, one of us will be dead. Like, I'm sticking around, although, well, I guess maybe not, but I mean, I theoretically, at least I'm sticking around to find out what's going to happen if I'm reading a novel, right? That is, you can, so, and so you can create by actually being, you know, smart, slightly obscure, right, about the way that you're presenting work at the beginning. You can actually create a kind of rising energy at the end that gives someone a payoff for reading all the way to the end. Right. There's often these moments where people say things in their book, and I'm willing to say, look, whatever, this book is published by University Press. I trust you. You have a PhD. You're at a university. Whatever. Like, if you want to just say these things are true and then don't make me wade through all of the evidence, like, I'll just stipulate to it at some point. Right. Whereas if you're going to make me walk through all the evidence, I've got to be learning something. I've got to be engaged in some way. There's got to be something happening to me on page, 180 that benefits from, not necessarily required, but that benefits from the fact that I've read pages 100 to 179 and that will be in turn transformed by pages 181 through 200. Mm-hmm. Right. That is to say the work of the book, the work of a single paragraph has to be work in which there is a gain from engaging in all the parts of it. Because otherwise, you could just take the first sentences of the paragraphs and stick them all in a book and be like, read this. And then if you want the evidence, I'll put it all on the web and you can read the rest of the paragraphs. But really, you don't need to read it to have any of the pleasure. If we believe, right, that these words are important, that they're making a difference to the reader, then we have to write them in such a way that the reader's rewarded for the energy he or she spends on working through that project. And so what The Uneven You is about creating structures over and over that end at a place that's more interesting, more theoretically interesting, more sort of historically interesting, whatever it is, more potentially abstract, more compelling, larger in some sense, more summative, more oriented towards connection than the places they begin. So you begin on this lower sort of leg on the left side of the U, and you work through and you get down at the bottom of the U, and that's where evidence is happening. And then as you begin to rise up the other side of the U, you're analyzing your evidence, you're putting it together in relationships. And as you reach the very top of the U, then what's happened is that place where you began with on the other side finds itself transformed and shaped. And there's growth and change that happens at the top of that right side of the U. That's essentially the structure that I believe makes much scholarly writing powerful and good. It doesn't mean that all scholarly writing always has to do this. I don't personally write uneven new paragraphs or even sections all the time, but it is always in mind for me. And what I do in the book is I spend a lot of time, first of all, showing you this pattern at work and the work of other people who aren't me and who've never heard of The Uneven You, and then kind of breaking it down and showing you how to do that yourself. Mm-hmm. And the point here is A, that this is powerful for the reasons I've just described, but B, that this is in fact the source of the power of much of the work you're already reading. Right. And so that's where, again, that kind of prescriptive, descriptive sort of switch is happening. And you're moving back and forth between saying not only A, is this useful and creates power and force and engagement and energy on the part of the reader, but also B, it's been doing that the whole time, but no one had described it in the way that I'm describing it. And by describing it, I make it visible as a kind of basic rhetorical / epistemological structure of the way that academics write and communicate with one another.
So, Eric, have you tried using any subset of these methodologies to teach undergraduates?
Yeah, I actually developed many of them teaching undergraduates.
Really? Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a little bit? Sort of.
Sure. I mean, I think typically for a lot of people, I got my PhD in English, so I started in grad school as a teacher teaching composition. And one of the things that really bothered me about the kind of composition pedagogy that was dominant at the time was that it was very focused on writing as a kind of expression and as self-expression. And what it concealed for me was the fact that there were actually pretty clear patterns and structures and rules that you could teach people. And I felt at the time like that was, it was this weird way in which a kind of certain version of a kind of liberal writing pedagogy was actually bad for students because it made writing out to be a kind of matter of feel rather than what it often was for me, which was a matter of understanding patterns and structures and how they were put together to create force. That is, it made writing a little bit too magic. I think writing is magic, and my writing can be beautiful and create incredibly powerful effects. But I actually think most of the time, like magic itself, you can actually describe how it was done. And I don't think that describing how it was done and then teaching someone to use those same patterns diminishes the power or the magic that can be present in writing. So, you know, when I started teaching undergraduates how to write, I made up, basically this book is a compilation of things that I made up over the years to teach people how to write papers, essentially how to write academic papers. And, you know, some of the sentences in here are taken from handouts that I made for students in 1999 and 2000, 2001, when I was first teaching writing, at the college level as a lecturer and then as an assistant professor. What happened to me at the University of Arizona, which was the first time I was really teaching graduate students, was that I realized that, in fact, my graduate students needed the same instruction. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, maybe needed it more, because the people who tend to go to graduate school tend to have skipped all of the writing instruction they would have gotten in college, because they place out of, you know, they get a 5 on the AP exam or whatever it is. And so they end up placing out of writing. Mm-hmm. Sort of stuff. And they're often very good writers. They've had a very good high school education, so they're pretty good writers. So they don't get any writing instruction from their professors because they're always writing A papers. And so, the other thing is they've gotten into grad school because they're good at writing end of term papers in their undergraduate classes. And all of a sudden in grad school, they have to write articles and dissertations, and they've never written those before. And so this was this other sort of recognition, which was kind of epiphanic for me, of understanding that, in fact, this is a profession that is largely in which success at the research level, in any case, is largely oriented around writing. And that thinking of ourselves as writers and thinking of them as writers and then treating them as potential writers and as people who were engaged in, you know, in the process of learning how to write in very specific genres was going to be really helpful to them and was going to be kind of ethically pedagogical. So that's kind of where it comes from. But I think that, you know, for me, academic scholarship in the humanities is an incredibly successful genre, and it's an incredibly successful 20th century genre, let's say. And obviously, historical writing has a much longer history, and so does writing and literary criticism in general. But if you think about the post-45 shifts in the way that the writing of history, the writing of philosophy, or the writing of literary criticism, or cultural criticism have worked, it's been there's been a series of really dramatic changes. And it makes sense for me to think of myself as belonging to a tribe that is part of the production of a genre that's an incredibly successful genre. That is, it accounts for some significant percentage of the total words outputted by the human race in the last century. And it has a history, like the history of literature, right? And it has it can be described and studied, and it has practitioners, and those practitioners engage with it as a craft. And all of that makes sense and seems to me, again, you know, for a literature scholar, like something that should be completely and totally obvious. And I think technically maybe is, but it's not obvious if you look at the way that we put that into practice. That is to say, if you look at our graduate programs, you would say these graduate programs are run by people who, frankly, don't understand that they're part of a profession that writes.
Right. And so speaking of belonging and speaking of craft, I don't want to finish without talking about the last part of the book. So after these two really, really useful parts of the book that are devoted to strategy, including this uneven you and many other elements of strategic writing that go along with it, and then another section of the book that gives some really, really useful, very practical advice on tactics for how to manifest the kind of most effective versions of different elements of, you know, things like citational practice, the importance of repeating your major ideas, etc. There is a really interesting final fourth section of the book on becoming, on the importance of sort of becoming a writer, and then the importance of writing as a kind of lived practice and the transformations that can accrue therefrom. For you, what are the most crucial aspects of that fourth section and of this sort of larger discussion that you're giving us here on becoming a writer?
Well, I would say two things. I mean, one of the big things that I emphasize in the work about writing is that, in fact, you learn while you're writing. Mm-hmm. That is, writing is a thought practice. And that if someone says to you, I had a set of ideas and then I wrote them down, and over the course of the year that I spent writing them, I didn't learn anything new about those ideas, I would be very, very suspicious of the quality of those ideas and of the interest of the writing that produced them or that seemed to produce them. My feeling is that, certainly for me, but also for lots of other people I know, that writing is actually, as you're writing, you are thinking. That is, the relationship between the writing and the ideas that the writing produces is highly variable but integrated. That is, there are days where you write and you don't have any new ideas. There are days when you write and it's full of ideas and you have too many ideas and you have to get rid of some of your ideas, right? But and anyone who listens to this can try this. If you're writing something right now, start a new file, print out what you have and retype it, mm-hmm. and see what happens to you in the act of retyping those 20 pages, right? And watch how the act of retyping actively changes and reshapes what you actually already have written down. I don't mean as a revision. I mean just retype the whole thing into a word processor and see what happens as you feel the desire to change it as you're writing, and see also how the act of retyping changes what you're thinking. So at the end of so that's the fundamental ethos of writing, which is, I think that once we think of writing that way, the entire relation between writing and revision disappears. It's all just writing, right? There's no such thing as revision in a strong sense. They're simply writing. And when one is revising, one is writing. And when one is writing, one is writing. And that those are all part of a larger practice, that it makes sense to conceive of them as a larger practice rather than as two steps. This means that the work, as I say in the book, the work becomes itself. That you cannot know and you should not want to know exactly what you're going to say over the course of an article or a book when you start the article or a book. Because to know that is to block yourself from the kinds of excitement and change and innovation that can happen in the act of writing. And so you have to actually leave some room, even though it's a little bit scary, to let the work become what it is. Again, think back to the dissertation that I was describing for my graduate student, Grace. She found out in some ways what the work was about when she wrote the introduction. There were things that she thought the work was about. But she was always also throwing herself forward into a void, and it was the act of writing the introduction and of thinking in that way that allowed her to grasp the totality of the work in a brand new way. That was really, really vital for her. And I think if she'd written the introduction ahead of time, she would have always been thinking, "Well, this doesn't fit the introduction. I have to make this fit the introduction. Or I didn't say I was going to do this in the introduction." Whereas actually, by being open to the directions that the work took her, she was able to write a much better and more powerful work. So when you start writing a book, you know, and this is true for everyone, the book you're going to write could turn out 100 different ways. And how it's going to turn out is going to depend on what you read, on who you talk to, on the talks you give, on the conferences you go to, the people who are in your graduate cohort, if you're a graduate student. The point is to actually understand that that's a kind of form of becoming that you need to integrate into your writing practice. And that by allowing the work to become itself, you will stay open to the possibility of change. You will stay open to that right kind of rising arm of the NEU, which allows you to look back on what you've done with a new perspective and a new understanding. That's the first kind of becoming. The second kind of becoming that I'm interested in encouraging people to think about is the way what it would mean to become a writer. To ask yourself, what would it take for me to become a writer? To recognize that, of course, one is never fully a writer, but one always is in the process of becoming a writer and changing. It would be a very weird person who said, "I'm done learning about writing. Right. Everything I'm going to do from the rest of my career for the next 30 years is going to be written in exactly the same way I finally, at the age of 35 or 45, mastered writing." Right. And therefore, no changes need to happen. Right. So that writing is like that, a kind of continuous process. But what would it mean to commit to becoming a writer? Right. What would it mean to be involved in thinking in a continuous way about what it means to write and about what it would be? You know, I think I say this in the book. If you were a writer, what would you do? What would you do with yourself? If you think of yourself as a writer, how does that change what you need to be doing in order to be responsible to that fact? And there, I just think, you know, one of the simplest things is to think about writing in a different way, to teach writing in a different way, to engage in writing as a practice and a craft, to try new ways of writing, to try to understand how writing works. And that's part of the becoming. And I think, again, a profession in which that were happening would be a very exciting profession, a profession with probably more diverse and kind of experimental forms, which would be great. A profession where people talked about writing more openly, which would be really exciting. And a profession where writing was livelier and more free. And that seems to be good. And then the third kind of becoming that I talk about is I've just touched on, which is the kind of becoming that would happen in the profession, if this were to happen, but that also might happen in the smaller communities in which we all take part, which is to say the communities of one's friends, and of one's colleagues, in which there's also, I think, the possibility of a kind of becoming through writing that involves what happens when you exchange and share and grow with people, and what happens when you join with those in a kind of mutual process of growth and transformation, as not as a professor devoted to the reproduction of the neoliberal state, but as a writer and as someone who's taking his or her place in a long line of writers with whom one is always interacting and whose company is worth joining.
Well, Eric, thank you so much. There's a million other things that we could talk about, and that I'd love to keep you for another hour or two to talk about, but we are at the end of the hour. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
No, this was great, Carla. Thanks so much. And, I will say that I think this conversation makes the book sound like it's about bigger ideas than it is in the practice of actually reading it. There's a lot of very, very practical, small-minded, and I think hopefully helpful advice in the book. If I've seized this opportunity to talk about why I wrote the book more than about what's actually happening in the book itself, I apologize a little bit, but I think that for me, those things are both there in the book, but also in some sense the buried kind of ethical core of why I wrote it in the first place.
That's right. And, I think it's this conversation cannot be a substitute for the book itself, right? And so I think I encourage readers to or listeners to get a copy, because there is a ton of practical advice. And in fact, I think hopefully some of my colleagues will be using it to try to integrate some new stuff into the way we're teaching writing. So thank you so much, Eric.
You are welcome. Thanks, Carla.
You've been listening to the New Books Network seminar. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.